Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. The Landless Workers Movement, known as the MST, is the largest social movement in Latin America and perhaps the world. For decades, its members have fought to reclaim land from agribusiness and upstart capitalists, to educate the masses, and resist violent repression. Against the backdrop of Jair Bolsonaro's right-wing regime, the MST not only survived, it won the hearts of millions of Brazilians. How did they do that? And what happens now? How did this movement grow across generations, despite U.S.-backed coups and a global rightward shift? What's MST's role with Lula back in power? And with the far right nowhere near vanquished in Brazil, what could the future hold? Vincent Bevins is an author and journalist who has worked for The Washington Post, The Financial Times, and The Los Angeles Times, where he served for 5 years as a foreign correspondent in Brazil. He's the author of The Jakarta Method and If We Burn, The Mass Protest Decade and the Missing Revolution. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to The Nation Podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to begin with, first of all, your piece was such a pleasure to read. It is such a treat to have it. And in addition to giving us all some not only rare good news, but actually inspiring reading, I really found myself warming to your sensibility as a writer. And I'm gonna read a couple of sentences that give a taste of what I mean. You say, you're describing somebody who is a member of this movement, who's a farmer. You know he's a farmer in part by what we in New England call his farmer tan. And then you say, academics in the United States or Europe who read Antonio Gramsci might call him an organic intellectual, someone from the class whose interests he defends. Members of the MST might call him that too, because they also read Gramsci in their political education programs. And I thought that was a lovely, subtle, but still pointed reminder to those of us in the metropolitan north, not to make assumptions about people just because of where they spend their days or what they do for a living.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for looking at that. I mean, I guess that also gets us to one part of the questions that you asked at the beginning, and it's things that the piece asks itself. How is it possible that they've been so successful over now 40 years? I think that one part of that answer is their intense dedication to intellectual production and political education. So the MST has a publishing house. They have...
Can you tell us, just for my sake and for the sake of readers who are not fluent in Portuguese, what MST stands for and how you would pronounce it?
Yeah, sure. MST is what everybody calls it in the shorthand. That would be the acronym for Movimento Sem Terra, the movement without land. There's a longer version, but the MST is short for Movimento Sem Terra. And everybody refers to it by the three-letter acronym.
Okay. And I definitely want to get a full account, or at least as full as we have time for today, on how they managed to survive through lean times, because, you know, I feel like that's the part that our readers are going to glom onto avidly and in some cases desperately. But let's start with their roots.
Yeah, so the MST was formed in the 1980s. Like the Workers' Party, the PT, this was the point of their inception. And the reason for that is pretty simple to understand. This is when the U.S.-backed military dictatorship starts to transition to democracy. That transition only happens by the end of the 80s. But in the 1980s, again, civil society starts to become possible very slowly. In the longer sense, they trace their roots to progressive elements of the Catholic Church, elements inspired by liberation theology and rural movements that had been active in the left in the first half of the 20th century. Now, they point to the fact, and they're not alone in pointing to this fact, that a push for land reform was what made it acceptable to elites in Brazil in 1964 to get behind a U.S.-backed coup and support the imposition of a military dictatorship. So this is a familiar story in Latin America. Land reform is also important in Chile in 1973. So the U.S.-backed military dictatorship really crushes all possibility for pressure from below on behalf of peasants or movements for land reform.
And of course, the U.S. in crushing this movement for land reform in the 60s, which is to say under the Johnson administration, cooperating with this Brazilian dictatorship, did so in the name of anti-communism. That was, as it were, our global ideology at the time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Behind the scenes, we now know that. Although the president of Brazil that was overthrown at the time, his himself was a large landowner, and he was very, very far from being a communist. He was something more like a reform-minded liberal in the U.S. context. What we do know is that behind the scenes, U.S. foreign policy officials were worried that Brazil could become, quote-unquote, the China of the 1960s. I think that was a huge exaggeration, but this was the justification for all kinds of interventions in South America. But there was also reasons that local elites chose to go along with these kinds of interventions. And land reform was one of the major things that President João Jean Goulart was pushing that pushed elites over to the side of backing an anti-democratic coup. So back to the 1980s, as civil society starts to become possible again, landless Brazilians in the South start to use direct pressure on the state, and the occupation of fallow land or illegally used land becomes at the time the main tactic of the MST, and it remains the tactic of that the MST prefers to this day. And this was a way to get the government to do what it was supposed to be doing when it came to land reform. So on the books, there was a law, and there is a law, allowing for the redistribution of land which is not used, because it has been passed down through the feudal Portuguese system, through elites that don't care about doing anything with it or that is being used illegally, and the occupation going onto the land and then turning around and demanding that the state recognize that this is a legitimate plot of land that can be distributed in the land reform program is what they've been doing for basically four decades.
So I want to unpack that a little bit. I'm sure you don't know this, but in the 1920s, The Nation published an editorial called Seize Every Empty House, which was essentially calling for New York City to take over every apartment that was not being occupied and used. So the idea of appropriating unoccupied dwelling space or farming space, the populists in the U.S. also had a similar program. So there was nothing, this was not something that was unique to Brazil or unique to the 1980s, but there was this feature of the Brazilian Constitution which allowed this movement to have a cloak of legality that other expropriative movements may not have had. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So quickly, the MST also, there is an urban occupation movement, the MTST, which could be the subject of another very interesting story. But also the MST looks very closely at the way that land reform went in the United States. As I said, they take very seriously the study of all global social movements and all global pushes for redistribution, and they look very closely at what the populists did in the United States indeed. So when we do get the new constitution in 1988, there is an article that allows for the redistribution of land which does not, quote unquote, serve a social function. And this is the real site of contestation between groups like the MST and old large landowners, somehow sometimes often being, as I said, actual feudal landowners, over what is to be done with the huge amounts of Brazilian land that has not been put to productive use for a long time. So what the MST does is that they rely upon this part of the Constitution to make their case legally that their occupations can be recognized and that the land can be distributed to them when the state deems that it is correct that the land has either been fallow, unused, or used illegally. So while they do immediately on their own act to literally physically occupy land, they immediately turn around and begin to negotiate with the state. And this is one thing that's interesting to discuss, is that they see extraction of state resources as a legitimate and fundamental part of what they do. So they believe that the state responds primarily to the ruling class. They're quite class-based in their analysis of Brazilian democracy. And so they believe that the ruling class has all kinds of ways that they are able to pressure the government outside of institutional channels. And they believe that the occupation is their way to do the same thing. So essentially they're saying, you're supposed to be doing land reform. We've found the land that you can distribute. Here we are making the case. And then they immediately enter into negotiations with the central government to try to get that to happen. Now, when it turns out that the state decides that this land was not used illegally, that it is not legitimate claim for land reform, then they move on. But this is their tactic. They immediately enter into negotiations with the state to demand or extract resources.
And when they get recognized, you give us the names in Portuguese of a settlement that's an occupied settlement and a recognized settlement. So say a little bit about that. And also, what happens when a settlement is recognized? What happens to people who live there? What happens to the land? What do they do with it?
Right. So this is a very large social movement, as you said. They have somewhere between 400 and 500,000 families that are either encamped or settled. That would be probably the best translation of acampadas or assentadas. And so with an organization of this size, you have a complex organizational structure. And so when you're perhaps entering for the first time, like if we can sort of create a sort of ideal type chronological lifespan of a particular MST member, you're probably going to be recruited, or if you don't have somebody that's already in the movement, you might be recruited by the MST's outreach program that's quite active in sites of urban poverty, and you will be recruited to probably be part of an encampment. So if a site of land is identified as being a legitimate target for occupation, a lot of people will, in the early morning usually, and usually a mix of people who have done this kind of thing before, but are also, and some people who are there for the first time, will go and they will occupy that land. The MST is very insistent that people learn in the struggle, but they're not supposed to learn everything on their own. There's going to be people there that have done this before. And then once they're there, they immediately set up an encampment. So the tent would be the iconic site of the encampment. And then they start living on that land. They start trying to farm. They start trying to create all of the structures that would be part of a long-term settlement. So that will be schools, that will be political education centers. They will create an organizational structure where every person is part of a small collective unit. And then they will be asking the state to recognize that the encampment become a settlement. And what that would mean is that the state would legally grant the right of these families to live on the land and to farm the territory as they please. Now, in both phases, the encampment and the settlement, the MST will be producing food for its own consumption, but people will be allowed to use their own plot as they like. So they, with the crops that they grow, they sell them on the market, they have an income. So this is another thing that's very attractive about the MST for people who might be at that phase of being recruited, is that not only are you immediately part of a struggle with serious political, even revolutionary, long-term aspirations, but immediately you're going to have a place to live and an income. Right. So immediately, not only does it respond in the long term to the transformative aspirations of sort of the working class of Latin America's largest country, but people that with real material needs will have them met every single day by this group. So to get to the end of my answer to your more simple question, once the government says, oh, yes, this land has been settled, this is part of the land reform program, now your right to legally occupy a given plot is recognized by the federal government, and you can do what you want with that land. Usually, you know, the people will farm it and then sell produce on the market while continuing to participate in MST activity.
So when the encampment becomes a settlement and the government recognizes it and you have legal status, who holds the title to that land? And is it held by the individual campers? Is it held collectively by the MST? Is it transferable? Could you build a small resort hotel on your plot if that's what you wanted to do?
It's a very good question. And the ambiguity, or at least the perceived ambiguity around some of these questions, is often where real conflict arises. The family that is quote unquote settled is recognized as the legal occupier, but does not have the right to buy or sell the land. So the land still is owned in the sense that we would understand in the United States by the government. You cannot turn around and say, I would like to sell this to somebody who's going to deforest this. Now, on the margins, you get people doing this illegally, or you get people pressuring people, often through violence, to quote unquote sell plots of land which cannot be sold legally. And we see cases like this, as I said, leading to violence. But you cannot if you're a part of the land reform program, you cannot sell the land, but you can use it as you please to sell products on the market and make yourself a nice income, depending on what part of the country you're in.
And can you pass along the right to live and farm on that land to your descendants?
Yes. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And if the land is declared vacant, you know, and this happens too, a given family might be on the land for a while, and then everybody in the family, because you get MST families where some people, as I say in the piece, some people really want to farm. Some people get very excited, interested in the theoretical side of the MST's intellectual production, and then they'll go off to study in a political education school. They might become full-time militants in the MST. They might end up becoming their own organic intellectuals for their state. And sometimes you get people having kids using MST plots of land to provide an income for families. And then both of their kids, it turns out, oh, you know, my daughter wants to be a chemist and live in the city, and my son is a professional football player in the third division of the Brazilian league. And then when there's nobody else that wants to stay on the land, then it will become vacant again, and the government can pass it to somebody else.
But it's the government who can pass it to somebody else, not the movement.
If it is your descendant, it's very likely that you'll be able to pass it on to your descendant. When there is a vacant piece of land on a part of Brazil that is the MST has made available, the MST will have a lot to say of who gets recommended for the next plot. Technically, in no case is the MST allowed to assert at all who gets the land, but their entire game is providing lots of pressure to make sure that it does go to them and that the land does get distributed.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, it's all fascinating. And part of what's fascinating is the kind of thoughtfulness of the structures designed to minimize corruption, for example, or, you know, minimize exploitation. And I just think that those are really interesting features. I want to focus in on a couple of micro things just because maybe they'll be interesting. One thing is you talk about the roots of the MST in both the kind of organicism of the Liberation Church, Catholic Church, and in the sort of rural Communist Party from the 30s. What is the MST's relationship with the PT, with the Workers' Party, Lula's party? Do they have different roots? Were they founded roughly in parallel? And what is their relationship?
They have different roots. They were founded roughly in parallel. And they have a sometimes fractious alliance that is very important. So on the one hand, the PT emerges from the trade union movement in the most industrialized and most urban part of Brazil, in the industrial pole in Sao Paulo, the largest city in South America. And again, in the case of the PT, links with progressive elements in the Catholic Church are very important. Links with remnants of the left from the earlier parts of the 20th century are very important. So in the case of the PT, you have a lot of trade union activists, you have a lot of progressive Catholics, and you have some former guerrillas, people who had fought against the dictatorship, perhaps been imprisoned or tortured. Dilma Rousseff, of course, being the most famous example of someone that was tortured and then becomes a prominent Brazilian politician. In the case of the MST, you have rural activists and progressive elements in the Catholic Church. And instead of links to guerrillas that took up arms in the late 60s, they have links to the peasant leagues, which were allied with the Orthodox Communist Party of Brazil, the PCB, up until the 1964 coup. Now, the MST will tell you that they are incredibly proud of having fought off Bolsonaro and having fought to get Lula out of prison when he was put in jail, as a result of an anti-corruption campaign, which has now been discredited and judged illegal by the Brazilian Supreme Court. They will tell you that they're very proud that they were the only group to put people outside of his prison every single day, demanding that he be released. And they will tell you that they helped to put him back in office. But what they will tell you is that means that they have a right to ask for things, that it is their government, that the government owes them things and not the other way around, right? So talk about these moments in the story. After Bolsonaro is narrowly defeated in his attempt to destroy democracy in Brazil, because from the very beginning, and I've been writing about this for years, Bolsonaro's project was really to exterminate the Brazilian left, and they would have really loved to get rid of the PT, and they would have really loved to crush and destroy the MST. And after Bolsonaro was narrowly defeated in 2022 and the PT comes back into office, the MST immediately takes action again, and they take action in a way that surprises the PT. You could say annoys the PT. They go further than what the PT would like them to be doing. And the MST sees that as their, not only as their right, but they see it as the way that they can best respond to the hundreds of thousands of families that they represent. And also, at the same time, they will tell you very quickly that if there is another risk of destabilization or a risk of far-right takeover of the country, they will go back into a defensive posture to defend the PT as the best available option right now to hold a bulwark against fascism.
Well, we'll get to the defensive posture and what it entails in a moment. But, you know, here on The Nation, we have more interest than any other mainstream publication, probably, in the narcissism of small differences.
Right.
So I'm going to. So my question is, I noticed the, you know, you said there's a MST stands for Movement Without Land. There's a longer phrase, and the longer phrase includes the word workers, trabajadores.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting, you know, from a, if you like, a left historical point of view, that they define themselves as workers, not peasants. And I wondered whether you felt that was deliberate and it meant something ideologically, or it was just a coincidence?
It does mean something ideologically. As I keep saying, the MST has a very serious program to develop, maintain, and pass down a coherent version of Brazilian history. They have their own reading of Brazilian history and how it fits into the larger story of revolutions and land reforms and social movements going back centuries. And their narrative is that in Brazil, indigenous Brazilians and then enslaved Africans and also later immigrants from all over the world worked on land, and they were expelled from that land by a technological revolution and sent into urban poverty. And so they had previously served as workers in a feudal system, and they were expelled from the land, and this is how they became landless workers, landless rural workers, to fill out the full name, trabalhadores rurais. And so what they believe is that many of the people who have been shoved into urban poverty, in some cases, you know, the favela being the most famous of that, their place would have been on the land if Brazil had taken the turn that what they call the liberal revolutions had provided for Europe and North America, a land distribution program in the period of the rise of the bourgeoisie. So now they also argue that Brazil missed that turn, that history turned and Brazil failed to turn with it, which is one of the reasons they identify the United States as taking off in relation to South America. Things like the Homestead Act, although they're very critical of a lot of the conquest of North America, is something they point to as a moment that Iberian America fell behind, Anglophone America. And so then, in the 20th century, they look to more radical land reform programs, which provide a quicker catch up with the first world. So they look at China, they look at Cuba, they look at the Soviet Union. But then at the same time, they are very aware that they work within a liberal democratic system in Brazil that they absolutely want to defend against a far-right resurgence. That's a long, answer, but they trace their links to the rest of the global left and to the traditions of liberal land reform very carefully in their political education programs across the country.
It's a long answer, but it was every bit the answer I was hoping for, which is, you know, placing this in context and also helping us to see, you know, like one of the things that's clear about them from your article is they are not accelerationists.
They do not
believe that when things get bad, that's better for them, and that they should abandon bourgeois liberalism to the likes of Bolsonaro so that they can accelerate the coming of some apocalyptic revolution. And I wonder, you know, could you say a little bit more about how they arrived at this view and then what it enabled them to do when Bolsonaro came to power?
So there's two ways to answer this question. And on the one hand, some of the more prominent intellectuals are quite orthodox Marxists of the type that would tell you that they would have loved for land reform to have made possible rapid industrialization in the early 20th century, for the entire country to develop along sort of the stages that would have been imagined as appropriate in the era of Industrial Revolution and then transition from to capitalism and transition to socialism. On the other hand, they were born in the fire of the end of the dictatorship. They slowly built a structure over 40 years that, as I said, was about not only pushing for long-term radical transformation, but about maintaining the quality of life, the answering the material necessities of real families every single day. So another, you know, a focus of my recent work, my second book talks about this quite a bit, was an explosion of mass protests in 2013 that very quickly took on dimensions that the original organizers, a left anarchist group that was protesting against a bus fare increase, had ever imagined. And at this time, the MST enters the scene and says, you should negotiate with the government. You're betting on the kind of chaos that can be more hurtful to our side of the political spectrum than it can be beneficial. So over 30 to 35 years, they came to be very quite worried about what destabilization means in Latin America. Often destabilization is caused on purpose to justify a right-wing coup. For example, Bolsonaro himself in 2022, his supporters tried to shut down the roads in the country, making the circulation of goods impossible as an excuse to restore order by imposing the rule of the great leader. And so by very carefully studying the history of how things go in Latin America when there is that kind of acceleration, just chaos all around, they decided, you know, they analyze in particular instances. As I said, they're pushing Lula harder than Lula would have, you know, many people in his government would like to be pushed right now. But they also are very, there's one phrase that Mauro Gilmar, one of the people that I interviewed twice in the story, he told me, I don't know how to translate it, but he says, like, look, we push for radical change, but we're not wackos. Like, we know that this can be very dangerous. And they have a critique of their reading of geopolitics over the last 10 to 15 years, and is one which posits that the U.S. and what they would call the U.S. empire's allies have taken advantage of destabilization or have caused destabilization around the world to push their own agenda. So they are absolutely aggressive when they think that they can achieve real goals, but very willing to be defensive when they think the danger is greater than the opportunity.
Right. So when a liberal government is in power, they expand occupations, push harder for legal recognition. What was their response to Bolsonaro in power in terms of their own activities and where they devoted their efforts?
So this what happened here is really what was most unexpected for not just me, but for many Brazilians that have been looking at the MST over the last 40 years. Because, of course, you know, I first moved to Sao Paulo in 2010. The MST has been a force on the radical left of South American politics for a long time. Now, when Bolsonaro comes to power in 2018, he really wants to exterminate the MST. Ricardo Salles, the man that he makes as environmental minister, has run on a campaign in which he distributes a pamphlet indicating, I mean, with a wink, I suppose, but indicating quite clearly that he supports the murder of MST activists. He says that bullets are the solution to MST and the left on the ground across Brazil. Bolsonaro clearly wants to crush and destroy and exterminate the MST. Now, what the MST has done, starting in the period slightly before this, when they believe that there is the risk of real reaction, is they adopt a posture called active resistance. Now, again, the MST's organizational structure matters quite a bit for this, as it does for almost everything else that they do, because it is possible, and you know, in many other parts of the world, other progressive groups, this would not be possible, for a group of somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million people to more or less as a collective all shift posture together. And so what they do is they decide to focus on the activities that they think will be most fruitful in a period of reaction and attack upon them. And so they don't halt occupations, but they choose to avoid occupations that the government, Bolsonaro's government, could use as an excuse to crush them. And they shift, especially as the pandemic arises, into the large-scale production of organic food that is distributed in the cities. So that's one part of their strategy of reaching out to the cities. Yeah, please.
Why organic food?
Well, they've come around to, in the last few years, in general, insisting on more sustainable practices. One of the things that they would like to do is not only to make it so that Brazil's land is used to do more to feed the local population, because as it is right now, Brazil's primary export in GDP terms is soy, often to China, to feed animals in China. So not only they want to make more of Brazil's food available for internal consumption, they're pushing for more sustainable practices and the preservation of the Brazilian environment.
So it's not a deliberate targeting of the urban haute bourgeoisie.
Well, there's that too. So the active resistance strategy has a subdivision, which is the outreach to the cities, which has two prongs. And the most obvious of which is just supplying tons and tons of food to the Brazilians that experienced starvation during the pandemic. And this is, you know, living through both Trump's first term and Bolsonaro's presidency. Bolsonaro's presidency was a period in which things really got worse materially, very visibly all around you. People were starving on the streets. And the MST stepped in and provided huge amounts of food to the urban poor. And this got them huge amounts of support in the favelas and in the peripheries of Brazil's major cities. But they also around the country had opened a set of shops. These are called the armazéns do campo, something like the storehouses from the countryside is probably the best translation. And the interesting thing about these armazéns is they actually were not opened in order to make a profit. That was not the point. The point was to provide a showcase in the cities, located sort of like where the cool, culturally connected, trendy, progressive elements of the urban bourgeoisie might live, and show them, this is what we make. Here's our coffee. Here's our chocolate. Here's our beans. This is what we're doing. And then they also began to sell t-shirts, hats. I opened the piece describing the way that the hat became a real fashion accessory in the second
half. The hat which we've put on our cover.
Yeah.
As the other red hat.
Which is interesting because when I wrote the first draft of this story, Donald Trump had not been reelected. I had stopped thinking about the MAGA hat. But again, this that framing that you came up with is quite interesting now that the man is back in power. And yes, this was the other part of the strategy. Part of their defensive posture was to form what, again, Gramsci would call perhaps a counter-hegemonic bloc with possible allies in the urban bourgeoisie, right? People that are looking for who's around on the left that can play defense against Bolsonaro. And a lot of the people in the cities look to the MST as one of, you know, not, you know, very understandably, as one of the most solid, best organized, and most ideologically coherent bulwarks against the far right insurgents in the country. And so, you know, throwing on the MST hat or an MST t-shirt in the second half of the Bolsonaro administration became a way to say, not only I support what they're doing, the farming that they're doing, but I'm against what Bolsonaro wants to destroy. I believe in the preservation of radical social movements in this country. And this was what surprised everybody as 2023 came around and Lula succeeds in spite of a coup attempt, in spite of an assassination attempt. The MST comes out of the period of reaction almost certainly stronger than when it entered.
That's so interesting, and particularly so interesting for us who are entering a period of reaction. I have a couple of maybe parochial questions, but so if you feel they're parochial, you can answer them very briefly. If you find them interesting, answer them more at greater length. You know, as an old newspaper man, I was delighted but somewhat surprised to note that they have a newspaper, and I wanted to know more about how that works, you know, what it is, how they use it.
So yeah, the Sem Terra newspaper has been around for 40 years. So I guess the larger way to answer your question is that they, as I said, they have a complex organizational structure and they take intellectual production very seriously. So they have a publishing house, they have a newspaper, they have a website, Brasil de Fato has a podcast. They are active at all levels of sort of, let's say, the battle of ideas in Brazilian society. The print newspaper would have been more important previously than it is right now. And the MST is divided into sectors, right? So in the national leadership, every state is represented and every sector is represented.
So what is meant by sectors?
It is the divisions of the MST itself. So the one that would matter for the newspaper you just brought up is the communications sector. And the communications sector would have also been the people whose job it was to respond to the brief controversy on social media over the hat, because back when it became really, really popular, there was this little flare up on social media. Well, like, well, are the urban kids guilty of cultural appropriation because they're wearing the hat? The communications sector has a secretariat in every single state, and there is someone whose full-time job is to respond to these kinds of things. And they came back and said, no, actually, we want people to be wearing the hat as long as they understand what it stands for. But so you have also the education sector, the formation sector, which is the political education sector. You have a sector for LGBT Brazilians. You have the recruitment sector. And so not only do they take part in the battle of ideas, as you point out with this newspaper and all their other output, they have people who are dedicated full time to what they're best at. So you might come up through the organization and really gravitate to one sector or another, or you may not want to do any of that at all. You may not want to be involved at all in intellectual production, but they'll have people that are full time professionals working across a range of activities.
Now, if you're somebody who's involved in intellectual production, are you required to put in a certain amount of time hoeing beans?
So everybody, at a certain point, no. Right. So there are people.
I mean, I guess it's a crude signal, but I guess I'm wondering, you know, how Maoist is this?
Yeah, no. So it's so at a certain point, no, there are people who are full time militants who might have family members that are on the land somewhere or another. But no, there are people who live in the city full time and do full time administrative work or communications work or run a publishing house. No, you're not required to like also be involved. But the opposite is not true. You're not allowed to skip political education. So even, and I, you know, and you meet guys like this that they just want to hoe beans. They do, you know, I just want my income. I really like farming. I like living out here on the land. I don't want to be involved in protests, whatever. The MST is quite insistent that as soon as anybody joins an occupation, joins any group at any level, they will go through some kind of a political education. So every farmer has to do education, but not everybody in education is also doing farming.
Very different from, for example, the Park Slope Food Co-op.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
How would you compare and contrast this movement? It's obviously more successful, much broader based, has a much larger membership with, say, I don't know, something like DSA in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Demographically, if you walk into a room of MST members, you're going to notice a big difference very quickly from the DSA.
Because they are people from the land.
They're working class Brazilians. They are going to be people that have lived either on the land or in urban poverty. You're going to get all ages. The DSA will appear different demographically. The MST does not have the kind of caucuses that DSA has. The MST has, as one of the major intellectuals of the movement put it, some kind of a hybrid between democratic centralism and decentralization. So on the really big questions, the questions that at a national congress they will have hammered out as part of their 5 or 7 year plan, individual chapters don't reinterpret those on their own. Now, when it comes to day-to-day questions, they, as much as possible, try to operate according to consensus. Everybody is part of a 10-person núcleo de base, kind of like a base committee. But I would say that in general, without being all the way at one end of the spectrum, the MST is much more insistent on collective action. And so this is one thing that I asked one academic about this in my research for this story. You know, what is it that people find surprising or critique about the MST? And she said, well, often activist folks from the United States will go to Brazil and be surprised at how collective it really is, how as an individual, you're not really allowed to call out something that you don't like. As an individual, you're not really allowed to make any major decisions on your own. Everything's going to have to go through your base committee of 10 people. And then on the big, big questions, that word democratic centralism might be used to indicate that, well, we're all really doing this. So ideologically, that is one thing that's different. And then also MST is very, very insistent upon and adept at extracting concessions from the state. And this includes parts of the state that are not left-wing. And I intentionally, for the article, went to parts of the country that are dominated by the Bolsonarista right. Paraná is a state that is a real center of reaction. It was the center of the Lava Jato anti-corruption campaign. And they will, for example, build a school there because there's political education, but then there's regular education, which is when they put their students through the same national curriculum that the rest of the Brazilian youth go through. They will build a school, make sure that it's up to standards, make sure that they have the facilities necessary to make it into a public school, and they will lobby local officials quite aggressively, including right-wing officials, to make that a real school, to make that part of the national system. And this is one of the things that's kept the movement alive for a long time. So they've developed sort of over 40 years quite coherent and sophisticated ways of interacting with the state and extracting resources from the state. And now the DSA, you know, I don't think through any fault of its own, the resurgence has been since in the last 10 years. I think that's not something that you see, for example, in Kansas or Arizona, for example.
Right. Very interesting. Thank you. Okay. I could do this all day, but so thank you for being patient, and thank you for this incredibly interesting article, which, as I said, in a pretty dark time, you know, offers not just hope, but sort of a concrete example of something that has worked and enabled the forces of the left to survive a really, really hostile environment. So incredibly valuable. To you, the last question, which I always ask, which is there something that I should have asked you that you wanted to be asked and we haven't?
No, not at all. I kept finding a way around to it. But I think the core, the thing that is really interesting that the MST always pointed me to when asked about how they were able to survive is this organizational mix that they have, that they can be, that they are well structured but also flexible, that they can be firm but also malleable, that they can really respond to people every single day, whereas they have a long-term vision at the same time. And again, that's not something that I think you can just copy and paste. I think it's very, very hard to build. I don't think a group like the DSA or like any other of the progressive groups that I know around the world could be faulted for not having pulled off this strange mix that's made them such an important part of Latin American politics for the last 40 years. But their approach to these organizational riddles and their intense dedication to resolving those riddles over and over and over for as long as possible, I think, is one of the things that has most interested me about them.
Okay. Thank you so much. Vincent Bevins, his cover story, This Land is Our Land, is in the April issue of The Nation. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, and you've been listening to The Nation podcast. Thank you.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.